you know, I think I have a desire to show people what else is out there, even if it's that place in the middle of nothing, and maybe hoping that people will start to appreciate those places more because they do have so much to offer. But I think it again goes back to just reacting, just being in those places and reacting.
This photography podcast is brought to you by Frames, quarterly printed photography magazine. Here is your today's host, W. Scott Olsen, with another fascinating conversation.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to another podcast from Frames Magazine. My name is Scott Olsen, and today, folks, I'm really looking forward to today because I got to tell you, one of the perks of having the position of Frames that I've got, you know, in reviewing books is that I get sent some really nice photo books throughout the year. And I got sent one just, you know, a short while ago. I'm going to use a technical term here. This one was cool. This one just absolutely spoke to me because it hit a lot of the sensibilities that I have. And it's the kind of project that frankly makes me, you know, envious and jealous and filled with admiration. It's a book called Roadside Meditations by Rob Hammer. Rob is a San Diego-based photographer, and he's just got a stellar career on the commercial side, doing a lot of sports stuff. He's shot Kobe Bryant, Shaquille O'Neal, Kevin Durant, Steph Curry, I mean, all sorts of A-listers. His clients are Nike, Adidas, Under Armour, Reebok, Foot Locker. Works appeared in Runner's World, New York Times. I mean, just the resume goes on and on with fantastic stuff. But even beyond that, and this is where we're going to focus today, even beyond that, he has these huge personal projects that the minute you open them, the minute you start looking at them, you think, oh, man, I'm with you. And sometimes you're thinking, I wish I would have done that. But mostly it's this stuff is cool. Rob, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Scott. Appreciate you having me.
Oh, I'm looking forward to this. Rob, you know, I got Roadside Meditations, and I'm a big road trip fan, and we'll get to that in a second. But I was reading the introductory stuff. I was reading the background stuff. And you've got a couple of really cool stories about how you even got started loving road trips and then how photography sort of took over what you were doing. So for the people that, you know, haven't had a chance to read this yet, bring us up to speed with, you went to military school, when you were getting out on leave, the road trips became, you know, a part of your life. Tell me about this early love for hitting the road.
Yeah, sure. Can I just give you a compliment first, though, since you made me sound so cool in the beginning here?
Well, sure. We'll edit it out. But anyway.
Well, please don't, because I want people to hear this because I love the work so much. I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed going through your Scenes from a Moving Window.
Oh, thank you.
I'm about halfway through now. I just finished up Sunset Limited, mm-hmm. The Los Angeles to New Orleans section. And man, it is so much fun. I'm enjoying it so much. Not just the content, but kind of the way that you released it as a chapter digital book, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Really, really fun stuff. And you completely changed my thoughts about train travel, which prior were, I just had no interest. And now it is moving up the list to a must do.
Oh, well, it was a must do for me. And the problem is it became a must do now in lots of other places. And, you know, I want to go ride, you know, the major trains all over the planet.
Yeah.
But it is a unique switch to the photographic world when suddenly you're moving at 100 miles an hour trying to do landscape stuff. It was a challenge and a thrill. So thank you for that.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Well, but okay. Now tell me about an early love for the road trip.
Yeah. So, you know, I grew up in upstate New York. Mm-hmm. My grandparents on my mother's side are from Boston, from South Weymouth, just outside of Boston. And we used to road trip there pretty often, maybe once a month, I guess, if you want to call that a road trip.
Uh-huh.
You know, I think when you're that young, it certainly seems like a road trip. And it just seemed like a fun adventure, you know, going to a different mm-hmm. place. And like I mentioned in the book, I mean, at the time, I was small enough to do that entire ride just laying on the floor in the back seat.
Yeah, you said you did that in the Chevy Blazer. Man, that's not a comfortable place to rest.
No, it's it certainly is not. But I don't know. I think that that just sort of added to the fun, you know? And, you know, it's so hard to nail something like that down. But if I had to guess, I would say that that's where it first started. Taking those trips to my grandparents' house and it feeling like an adventure, you know, getting out of our town and going somewhere new and fun. And then I guess, you know, as you mentioned, the whole military school thing, man, I despise that place. And I still do, unfortunately. Something I'm working on. But, you know, the first year there, you're not allowed to leave. It's essentially a year long boot camp added on to school.
Right.
So you're not allowed to leave. The next year you get a little bit of freedom. And when I say a little bit, I mean a little bit. And every single chance I had, I would get in the car and I would just go wherever. I would go to visit friends in New York or Connecticut or Massachusetts, wherever, you know. And I was so jealous because all my friends were actually having what a college career is supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, those leaving school and just being on the road was, it just felt like such freedom, and just, I was able to calm down and all the anxiousness from being at school just kind of went away. And, you know, so that certainly added to my, I guess, love for being on the road and just it being such a peaceful place.
Well, you know, it certainly shows in your work. And, you know, for many of us, the road is an invitation. It is freedom. You know, it's not something to be suffered and get done with. It's that, you know, the trip itself is the whole purpose for the expedition. But you go out west, you start doing, you know, odd jobs, stuff like that. And you say, you know, through all sorts of early changes, the one constant was the camera. But you never really said how the camera first came into your life, when you first started taking pictures, and why that appealed to you.
I'm still trying to answer that, honestly. there's a couple things that point to why. My grandfather was a professional wedding photographer.
Oh, okay.
My old man was a hobbyist photographer, I guess you would call it. He really enjoyed it. And I remember being a kid, he would come back from trips. My mother would go on. They didn't necessarily do a lot. And their one big thing that they would do is once a year they would go to England. They loved Britain. Mm-hmm. And they would go for like a month and they would come back, and my old man would have some friends over, and he would do a slideshow on I'm sure you remember those old, when you put your slides into the mechanism that puts it up onto a screen.
Yeah. There's the screen that you could never get to open, right? The little carousel, you know, for the, I remember many, many of those.
Yep. So, man, I remember thinking, like, Dad, nobody wants to look at your pictures. You know, I thought it was just the lamest thing in the world. And, you know, looking back on it now, I think it was probably pretty cool. And obviously we do that now just in a totally different form, but I don't know, maybe those two things had an effect. Certainly everywhere that I went, I would carry cameras. Back then it was just the, those disposable things from Rite Aid or CVS or whatever, which I don't know if they're around, but That was certainly the start. It was just the going on trips and taking disposables.
Did you look at the work and think this is pretty good, or was it the act of shooting that was more calling to you?
No, it was shit. I don't know if you could call it work so much as just documenting fun with my friends or whatever. You know, it didn't become actual work or photographs or whatever you want to call it until much later on. But the act was something that I really enjoyed.
Oh, that's, I mean, I see that actually in your work. I mean, we'll get to that a little bit. There's a kind of love for shooting that I think becomes apparent in the image itself. So, okay, you start doing some freelance, you know, proposals. You start trying to get in the commercial market, and eventually they start saying yes. Who were your first couple of clients? What were the first couple of successes?
I was living in San Diego at the time and not doing much. I got some gigs for really small local newspapers. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't even the Tribune, which is the big newspaper here. It was much more like a neighborhood type newspaper.
Yep.
And man, I think I was getting like $5 an image. And just, you know, did that a little bit. Really didn't know what I was doing at all. It was just kind of making it up. And I still think I'm just making it up. I think we all are, but that was kind of how it started. And I guess that gave me a little confidence. So I built up a little bit of a portfolio and was ignorant enough to think that it could get me somewhere. So I started showing it around, and one thing kind of led to another and another and another.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, in photography, we need to talk an awful lot more about patience and perseverance, because, you know, we're living in a society where you get published on Instagram 25 seconds after you've taken a shot. And you know, that's maybe that is going to be the next way that everybody gets discovered. But this idea of hustling, of getting your work out in front of people, the right people, is an important one. So, okay, you've got a career, things are going great, you get married, and I love this thing. You say in the book that, you know, you finally bought your wife the dog she always wanted.
Yeah.
And then you get on the road and you do 35,000 miles a year with the dog. You didn't buy this dog for your wife.
Yeah. Well, you know, I guess I would argue that, because I did as a placeholder, I don't know what the right word is, but it was essentially helping my fear of commitment with getting married. It was all right, well, you know, she's got the dog now, so we don't need to get married for a while. Was what it was. And it's, you know, not that I didn't want to marry her necessarily, it was just that my fear of commitment was so huge that it was like, all right, well, you know, the dog's the answer for now.
Right, but you take the dog with you on these massive road trips, which by the way, that's one of the things I'm really jealous about. I mean, that's sort of a classic American ideal, to hit the road with your dog. Let's just, you know, light out for the territory and see what we find.
Yeah, it's, for me, there's nothing better. You know, it's that experience cumulatively has been, without a doubt, the greatest of my life. You know, I mean, we lost him in April, but I had 10 years on the road with him for, like you said, 35,000 miles a year. I mean, everywhere. He went absolutely everywhere with me and us. So it was, I mean, that was really, really special. And, you know, it'd be a hard thing to replicate or even try to touch.
Yeah. You call your road trips treasure hunts. Why?
Yeah. Because that's exactly what they are. You know, I leave San Diego, and most of the time there's a destination of seeing family back home at Christmas time in New York.
In Boston? Oh, okay. Or in upstate New York? Yeah, okay.
Yep. So my family's still in upstate New York, so I'll drive there every Christmas. In the summer, I'll do a big trip. We go to Cape Cod every year for our family vacation. So those are always the destinations for the bigger trips. You know, I take a lot more during the year, but there's generally never a goal, or sorry, I shouldn't say a goal. There's never a plan in between. And I didn't realize this actually until a while ago when somebody pointed it out, but I guess what I'm doing is just reacting to what's out there and reacting to what really stimulates me. You know, obviously I have these projects I've been working on, but there's never a plan. I'm never doing research ahead of time as to where to go or what to photograph. It's just reacting to the stimulation, and those things that I find, I always just seem like, you know, golden nuggets. It just seems like treasure, and it's so much fun. It's just it's addicting. You know, I can't stop doing it.
It is. Now, you have these big multi-year projects, and we'll talk about several of them here in just a second, but if you're not planning, then you are not so much working on a project as you're working on everything and then organizing the shots later on. I mean, you know, American backcourts or barbershops, I mean, those really seem intentional, but are they simply, hey, now I have 250 shots of barbershops, let me do something with them?
Possibly. You know, I think I've gotten better over the years at the organization, but in the beginning with barbershops in particular, you know, it started locally. It just started here in San Diego as just a desire to document something that I really enjoyed and saw as disappearing. I had no intention of doing a book. I had no intention of going to all 50 states for it, but then it just kind of gets in you and you're like, you know, if I'm going to do this, I might as well do it all the way. So yes, there was, when I would go on the road, I would be looking for barbershops and then later I would be looking for the hoops for American backcourts, but it wasn't, okay, I'm going to set this destination of this town, or take this route specifically for these things. It was more just coming upon them.
And you know, I got to tell everyone, you know, these barbershops that you've got in this collection, we'll just start there, are classic old barbershops. The things, you know, where these are not sleek styling salons. You're not going to get a cappuccino in any of these, I think. And you know, the guy who's cutting your hair is older than your grandfather most of the time. But they are somehow revealing something about America, about, you know, maybe male culture, maybe about small towns. What about the barbershop, you know, struck your fancy?
I think it's, and again, this maybe didn't come to me until later, but one, I think that they're an incredible place for men to hang out. You know, right. They're sort of like a, not a clubhouse, that's the wrong word, but they're just kind of the safe haven for guys to hang out. And second, I just think they're this really special piece of American culture that is going away, unfortunately. You know, there's obviously the new barbershops, which are cool in their own right, but you can never, ever replicate or replace these old time shops that have been in the same place for 50, 100, 200 years. You know, I mean, that's just, they're time capsules. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, I got addicted and I was like, I just kept seeing them going away. You know, the barbers are dying or retiring or whatever. And along with them, their shops went, and they're just such incredible places. It's like, you know, how do you not document that and have a record of it?
And your work, frankly, is a really intimate approach to these barbershops. You know, and tell me, did you spend a lot of time there? I mean, have you got any hair left? I mean, you what?
Good question. When I started, I had a decent amount of hair. I no longer do, which is kind of a running joke about the project, you know, because I'm still working on it. I still, you know, whenever I'm on the road, I still look for shops and I feel bad because I have nothing to offer the barbers. Like, they're not making any money off me.
Oh, man. Well, I'm looking at one right now. The caption is Tony's Barbershop in Greenwich, Connecticut. Old guy in a white shirt. He's using a push broom for some hair on the floor. And what I admire about this, you know, it's such a natural picture, but that naturalness comes from a real, you know, relationship between you and him, a level of trust, and the brilliance of the lighting in that image, the way you've got the open door hitting his white shirt, his face, you know, half in light. It is backlit, it's moody, it's intimate, it's friendly, and this is not an accident. Or if it is, it's a hell of an accident. So you tell me the story of just that one image, if you would.
Yeah, it's funny you bring that one up because people definitely react to that that particular image. And I really like that one too, just because it is so natural and it just shows him in his environment, just doing what he does and has done for, you know, 50, 60, 70 years. Mm-hmm. I wish that I could say that it was planned, but it was, again, it was more of a just reacting to the situation of seeing him in that light and seeing him working. And it, you know, just one of those things where it kind of comes together.
Okay. Had you spent a lot of time in that shop?
I was there for a while, definitely. You know, each shop is so different. The way that the barber reacts to you, welcomes you, you know, the amount of time that you end up spending there is always different. It could be a half hour. It could be 4 or 5 hours. Mm-hmm. It just depends. And, you know, I think that there becomes a real value into being forgotten almost, you know, where you're just a piece of the furniture. You're just a fly on the wall, and you get to a point where nobody cares about you. It's like, oh yeah, he's just over there just taking pictures, you know, because otherwise you almost lose some of the candidness, you know, because a lot of these guys, I mean, they're from these small towns where they're not used to people coming in and taking pictures. So they maybe aren't so comfortable in the beginning, but once they get comfortable and they let their guard down, I mean, that's kind of when the magic happens. And those, you see those interactions between the barber and the customer who, you know, the two have known each other for who knows how long. And it's special.
Tell me about, this is for the whole series now, and we'll get to the other series in just a second. Tell me about composition, because so many of these shops, you know, what's on the wall is really interesting. Everything from, you know, a portrait of E.T. to civil rights posters to newspapers to, well, you know, one shop has, I didn't count, but I'm going to guess probably 2,000 business cards. And I mean, you sometimes center the barber chair. Sometimes you're not looking at that at all. Are you intentional with the composition? Or are you just looking for a serendipitous, oh, this is a neat arrangement, let me go that way?
I think that's hard to answer one way.
Uh-huh.
Again, I think it's a lot of it is their reaction to what's there. Sometimes you're really specific. Other times you make an image and you don't even remember doing it just because it's so natural. You know, you see something, you're like, oh, well, that, you know, that makes sense. I try to be very deliberate about making images of what makes each shop unique.
Okay.
So that, I guess that would be maybe the biggest dictator of what goes in the frame. But yeah, they're definitely very intentional.
Okay. And I mean, you've got a strong sense of design, a strong sense of art design in your images. There's the one shop that has the row of small metal, sort of a blue small chair. I don't know how to describe it, you know, but a whole row of them, and just one of them's not the same as all the others. It's just sort of, you know, and this is not the barber. This is not a customer. This is not the barber chair. This is something else in the shop. But the design value there is just through the roof. Tell me about, and we'll use this as a segue into your other pieces as well. Tell me about color as a matter of composition or as a matter of content.
You know, that's color, I think, is something as photographers we're constantly learning about.
Mm-hmm.
And something that I've really grown to appreciate over time is almost a lack of color. And when I say a lack of color, I don't mean black and white. I mean really muted tones or, you know, something that maybe has been bleached out over time to be, you know, it started as yellow and now it's just kind of off white or whatever it is, you know, I think it gives you cues as to, you know, how old it might be or where in the country you might be or what, you know, I'm not sure. It's such a hard thing to define.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was younger, there had to be so much color. You know, if a image wasn't bursting with color, then it was useless. And, you know, you'd go into Lightroom or Photoshop and you would boost that up and oversaturate the hell out of it. And now it's almost, I almost appreciate the more subtle muted tones more than that, the big saturation.
Let's take just a quick break. We hope very much that you are enjoying today's episode. The very fact that you are listening to this podcast suggests that photography means a lot to you. And if that's the case, you might want to have a look at Frames, quarterly printed photography magazine. We truly believe that excellent photography belongs on paper. Visit readframes.com to find out more about our publication. And now, back to today's conversation.
Color is clearly part of your compositional values. I mean, because they are striking, even in your black and whites, you know, the tones in there, the grayscales. Color is not irrelevant to the work that you're doing. It's part of the ethos, part of the emotion of the place. You must like basketball an awful lot.
I do. Yeah, I appreciate it for sure.
Okay, because you have two projects. One is just a lot of fun to look at, and that's the Venice Beach basketball project. But then you've got this whole thing on backcourts. Well, and I'll just let you describe it. You know, tell me what the backcourts project is.
Yeah, sure. So this is another one that's going back 10 years now, and mm-hmm. and sort of started on its own. I sort of didn't even realize that it was starting. And to be honest, I think that's how most projects start for a lot of people, at least for me. You know, you shoot these things kind of unaware, and then, you know, a couple months go by or 6 months or a year, and you're looking at Lightroom and you're like, shit, you know, there's this collection of images happened. This is, you know, this is something I'm obviously interested mm-hmm. in. It. But the start of it happened a long time ago. Like I said, my mother and her family are from Boston. So I was raised as a Celtics fan at a time when Larry Bird was the man. I read his book, and in that book there was a photograph or two. And one of the photographs was an image of his childhood hoop.
Okay.
It just blew my mind. Absolutely blew my mind that, you know, here's this guy who's the best of the best in the NBA. And then you see this picture of his childhood hoop, which is, it's just a rotting wood backboard hung on a barn that looks like you could push it over or the wind could blow it over. And it just, you know, dirt driveway just didn't make any sense to me. Just made zero sense. And, you know, after thinking about it for a while, I thought that image told such a great story about him and about hard work, about passion, all of that stuff, you know? And it just kind of got me thinking about the game in general and what stories these hoops could tell if they were able, you know? And yeah, that's kind of the start of it. It's just such a beautiful sport. And I just had this desire to kind of show another side of it.
And we should tell everyone, you know, this collection is a bunch of hoops hanging up in places that you wouldn't expect them. Although it seems perfectly natural going to some places, oh, I could put a basketball hoop there. And nobody bats an eye when you say that. But these are all weathered hoops. They're out of place. They are lonely, a lot of them. That one in Idaho with all the antlers, I don't think that one works, by the way. I don't think anybody's ever scored in that basket. But you brought up something that I do want to ask you. Do you consider yourself a narrative photographer?
Whew. That's a good question. That's something that's certainly changed over time.
How so?
I think when you're younger, number one, you have no clue what you're doing. You're just trying to get paid for pictures. You know, you just mm-hmm. want to be paid to use a camera. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you take any job that you can just so you can call yourself a photographer, you know, professional photographer. They get paid for what they're doing. You know, I started doing that whole athlete thing for commercial advertising work. And after a while, it sort of became kind of soulless.
Right.
You know, there's, I guess, again, when you're younger, you think, oh, this is so cool. You're hanging out with professional athletes, you know, some of the most famous people on the planet. And then you realize that all that work is just about seeing how many times you can get a logo into a picture to sell a product.
Yep.
And there's no, it's soulless. And then, you know, as time goes on, you sort of figure out what you want to do. And to bring it back to the whole roadside meditations thing is the road was my teacher, I guess. And I realized somewhere in there that yes, I want a narrative. I want to tell stories. So yeah, I mean, I guess I would have to agree with you.
Well, I think that is, I mean, with the barbershops, with the American backcourts, with Venice, even if we get into projects that, I mean, we won't have time to talk about, like, you know, the motels or the portraits, I think one of the really compelling things about all of your images is that they promise and they imply a narrative. They imply a story. And they sort of invite you in to sort of co-create that story, it's as I'm looking at your pictures, and say, you know, okay, what's going on here? How did this come to be? And, you know, what's in the frame and what's just outside, you know, that we're going to go around this corner and we're going to see many, many other projects out there. You know, American motels, you know, that's one that I liked an awful lot. But Roadside Meditations, the new book, which I'm feeling really sort of special today because I went on your website and it's already sold out, according to your website.
It's not. I actually don't have it yet.
Well, I've got it.
Well, you've got, I think, one of three on the planet.
Okay. Well, then I feel even more special. Everybody, you need this book. If you are a landscape photographer, if you are a travel photographer, if you are a nature photographer, if you have any interest at all in still images that provoke a sense of wonder and narrative, you got to get Roadside Meditations. But fill this in, since, you know, only three copies exist so far. Tell everybody what they're going to see.
Yeah. I should say that I will have it soon. So it's not like it won't be for sale, but,
right.
Yeah, it's, another, again, 10-year project that I sort of didn't know I was making until a lot later on. And yeah, it comes from my obsession with being on the road and traveling cross country and having it be, I guess, sort of a place of peace, you know, I live in San Diego and San Diego's great, but it's also kind of hectic. You know, it's crowded, it's overcrowded. There's tons of traffic.
Mm-hmm.
It's not necessarily a place that I connect with. So getting out of here is always great for me. You know, being on the road is my favorite thing to do. It's my favorite place to be. And it calms me down. It's almost like therapy, you know?
But these are not the usual set pieces. These are not the usual, almost cliched road portraits. You're going for something different here. And how did you decide when to press the shutter release? What is it you were looking at and thinking that this is something to keep?
Yeah. Well, thank you for saying that. I'm glad that you had that reaction to it because, you know, there's so much of the same photography out there.
Mm-hmm.
So many people documenting the same places, and I get it. They're beautiful. You know, it's like every gallery you go into, there's a picture of, slot canyons and the same piers in California and the Grand Canyon or whatever it is. I don't have any interest in those places. No disrespect to them. They're beautiful and all of that, but there's so much more to America than just, you know, those Instagram spots.
Right.
So I think I have a desire to show people what else is out there, even if it's that place in the middle of nothing, and maybe hoping that people will start to appreciate those places more because they do have so much to offer. But I think it again goes back to just reacting, just being in those places and reacting because they're so stimulating and so pleasing to me.
It's the pleasing part that really has me intrigued because one of the things I've noticed, and there are a couple exceptions in the book, but in general, you have a tremendous distance between foreground and background, which is obviously not true in the barbershops. It's not true in the basketball stuff because the subject is right there 6 feet away from you. But in nearly every image here, the full depth of content oftentimes goes for 10 miles into the distance. There is a sense of space, which is not a sense of loneliness. So tell me more about Promise.
Yeah, that's interesting. I never thought about it that way.
Sorry about that.
No, it's good. It's fun to hear your reaction, but maybe it's just my love for those big open places. Mm-hmm. You know, again, coming from San Diego, where you're right on top of each other. You know, like we share walls on each side of our townhouse, and you can't go anywhere without being on top of people or sitting in traffic. So it's those empty places they're pleasing, and they let you think, they let you calm down. They're overlooked. You know, so many people ask when I'm out on the road in those places, like, man, don't you get bored? Don't you get bored? And it's like, I don't understand how you could get bored. You know, mm-hmm. those places are so beautiful and so calming that, it's a shame that more people don't experience them.
Well, now, but okay, you've brought up people and you've brought up calming, and you've read nearly every image in here has some evidence of people, roads, buildings, power plants, fences, whatever. And there are no people in the book. Why?
Good question. A lot of that could have to do with the fact that there aren't a lot of people in those places.
Yeah, true.
Maybe a lot of that is intentional, you know, because a mm-hmm. lot of the other stuff that I work on does involve people. You know, the barbershop project obviously always involves people. Commercial photography always involves too many people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're on set with 50 to 100 people when only 3 need to be there. So, yeah, I don't know. I think that lack of people provides that calmness and the space to think and the space to create.
But it's not strictly landscape photography. I mean, there's nearly always some evidence that we've been there.
Yeah. I'm not sure how to explain that. I think it's maybe part of my obsession with America.
Again, implication is always intriguing, right? You know, mm-hmm. if you say, hey, you know, I want to tell you something, everybody leans in before you've ever told them anything. And so, you know, what I see with the roads, with the signs, I happen to have the book open right now to the one from Helper, Utah, with the Balanced Rock Motel, you know, an old sign, an old 7-Up sign. My Lord, you know, the narratives that are implied by any hotel, as you know, but then, you know, the roadside convenience store, a faded sign for something else. And then the ancientness of the rock, of the Western landscape sitting right there as well. And the crossed power lines, just at an aesthetic value from light and line, it's a beautiful image. But here's this motel that may or may not still be there. It's certainly old, in a town called Helper.
Mm, yeah.
So many things to just sort of wonder about. And that's what I really, you know, think this road trip stuff is about, is an invitation to wonder what came before us, what's around the bend, what history am I looking at? Because there's personal history and geologic history, a lot of cool stuff in there. Now, the really important question, you're out on the road. Did the dog help?
Oh yeah. That's oh yeah.
Instant friends with everybody.
It could go both ways, actually. A lot of the times he was a great icebreaker. You know, mm-hmm. most people like dogs. So it's in an odd way, I don't know, maybe it made me seem more trustworthy,
mm-hmm.
but it could go the other way too. You know, there are people who have bad experiences with dogs. You know, I remember a time in, I think it was Mississippi, staying in a hotel. I don't usually stay in hotels much anymore. I'll usually sleep in the truck, mm-hmm. but this was a time when I was staying in a lot of hotels, and I walked into the elevator with Mojo, and he's a big dog. And if you don't know him, he could be intimidating. And there was a girl in there, and we walked in, and this girl just instantly started bawling, crying, and moved to the back of the elevator, stuck herself in the corner, and just lost her mind.
Oh my.
So it goes both ways, but yes, I mean, overall it's been incredible. And the amount of people that we've met over the past 10 years that still ask about him is just, it's so endearing and so just heartwarming, you know, because he obviously was so special to me, and to have people remember him is just, it's special. It's great.
Yeah, I love the one small picture that you've got of the dog. I forget whether it's in the book or on one of your web pages. That was a great picture, as well as the one picture of you being turned into the police. But
oh, yeah. You saw that.
Yeah. we should probably, you should probably tell people that story now that we've mentioned it.
Oh yeah, that unfortunately is becoming something that happens too often. I like doing street photography.
Mm-hmm.
So whether that's in San Diego or when I'm on a trip, San Francisco or on an international trip, I love wandering around with a camera with, again, just no intention or plan or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like over the past couple of years, people have gotten very touchy. They've gotten very, very weary of people wandering around with cameras. And one day in a neighborhood, in southern San Diego, I was just wandering around taking pictures, minding my own business. And lady comes out of her house and asks me what I'm doing. I told her I was taking pictures, didn't really think much of it. And she kind of starts yelling at me. You know, there was obviously no convincing her, not that I did a very good job or tried that hard. But, she was just kind of hysterical and whatever she thought was going to be it, you know? So I just kind of walked away. Next thing you know, this guy pulls up in a truck, asks me what I'm doing. He's got a baseball bat in the truck. Like, you know,
oh my.
Yeah, it was interesting. And then a couple of minutes later, somebody else comes by and asks me what I'm doing. And I'm like, man, you know, how does word spread this quickly around a neighborhood? So she had, the woman had posted a picture of me on Nextdoor, that the website mm-hmm. Nextdoor, saying that I was, I forget what her wording was, but it was essentially saying that I was casing the neighborhood to steal people's belongings. And it's funny how the world works, because an art director that I'd worked with a long time ago at a magazine lived in that neighborhood. And she said, hey, I just want to let you know this is going around about you on the internet that you're casing people's homes. And, you know, just kind of got a kick out of it. But yeah, that's been happening more and more.
I would imagine on the road, though, the camera is more of an icebreaker and an invitation than a threat, isn't it?
It can be. Yeah, definitely. I think people can be very curious about what you're doing. And mm-hmm. in places where maybe there's not a lot going on, it's something that's new and fun and exciting, maybe.
Yeah.
You know, what's this guy doing here? Why is, you know, what's he up to?
Oh, man. Rob, what are you working on now?
Working for the past, year and a half or so, I started a project about cowboys and ranching in the West.
Mm-hmm.
That's been amazing. I've got such a huge appreciation for what those guys and girls do. And, you know, I've been trying to put myself in it as much as possible, you know, not just being there, but being out there with them, you know, which means, you know, sometimes being on a horse for 12 hours at a time and, you know, just being witness to what these guys do, to the work that they do, and trying to document it as best as I can.
And there's going to be a link with this interview, because some of those images are up on your website already.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's something else I'm trying to get better at is sharing work along the way, as opposed to not sharing it at all until it comes out.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I'm loving it. I'm having such a great time with it. And I think it's, again, just an incredible piece of American culture.
It is. And here's one that is people-centric. That I mean, you are really doing a kind of cultural anthropology or ethnography here to unpack visually the nuances of this culture. It's just remarkable work. But, you know, Rob, as I told you at the beginning, I'm a fan. I look at your work and man, I wish I was alongside with you. It is inspiring at every level. Thank you very much. I enjoyed the conversation.
Well, thanks, man. I did too. And, you know, maybe instead of putting a link to my work, you should put a link to your train ride work, because that's what people should be looking at.
Okay. Well, I'll talk to you later. Take care.
All right, man. Be well.
Frames. Because excellent photography belongs on paper. Visit us at www.readframes.com.